Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon.
Thanks, Beth.
Welcome, everybody. Anyone here in person for the first time tonight? Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to anybody joining us online for the first time. Welcome back, everyone else. Good to see everyone. I'd like to begin class by asking you to talk to each other. At home, I put you in breakout groups in the room. I ask you to just form small groups to have a short conversation in service of this being a place not just to learn about meditation, but to also connect with other meditators. And it's a central component of Buddhism to have the company of the wise, what we call Sangha. Sangha is the Buddhist, it's one of the refuges. Take refuge in those who are trying to be wise, those who are trying to awaken, to heal, to be happy in a wise way. And speaking of happiness, I wanted to, this is not an easy topic and talk for me, but I wanted to talk about happiness tonight and what it means and how practicing Buddhism increases our happiness and decreases our unhappiness. So for your small groups, I'd like to ask you to talk to each other. What does happiness feel like to you? How do you know? What are the signs of happiness? And what are some of the things and experiences, both internal and external, that bring that kind of happiness? We could also use the term joy, or maybe satisfaction is part of happiness. So topic is happiness, small groups. Breakout rooms coming in hot. Join one.
I'm going to be more than happy to do that.
About two more minutes, make sure everybody gets a chance to talk. One more minute, start wrapping up. I'm gonna try. Sometimes. It's a very low form of happiness. Yeah. It's a very low form, but it's a form. Always constant non-attachment practice. Will you pull that out? Good. Good enough. So I'll say a few things. Often we jump into a meditation after the small groups, but I'll say a few things to set up the meditation practice. And the traditional way that the Four Noble Truths are taught is that there is, and this is the core principles of Buddhism, of the Buddhist teaching, usually translated as the First Noble Truth, that there is the existence of suffering. But we could also just say unhappiness, that there's a level of unhappiness that is natural, that's part of life, that is not your fault, some of the unhappiness. The second noble truth could be said, we could say that it traditionally it's said that the cause of suffering, the cause of unhappiness is craving and attachment, clinging causes unhappiness. and that it's actually possible Third Noble Truth, traditionally enlightenment, nirvana, but we could say that the Third Noble Truth is that happiness is possible. The end of unhappiness, it's often usually translated as the end of suffering. The end of unhappiness is the Buddhist path, the Eightfold Path, the Eight Factors, the Fourth Noble Truth, the Eight Factors of the Eightfold Path is what needs to be done in order to be happy, in order to end unhappiness, in order to truly have a life that you enjoy and know how to navigate and feel satisfied and know how to deal with your pain. I mean, this is the Buddhist bummer that actually makes it trustworthy in my sense, is that there's nowhere in Buddhism that it says if you're spiritual enough, you'll get rid of your pain. It says if you are wise enough, you'll have a wise relationship to pain where happiness can coexist with unpleasantness. Rather than making our happiness dependent on pleasure and ease and comfort and a happiness that exists with the reality of life, and life is sometimes incredibly challenging and unpleasant. But it doesn't have to be suffering, it doesn't have to be unhappiness if we develop the wisdom that Buddhism teaches, guides us to develop. So several places, I mean, first of all, I'll just say that I believe that the core tool to happiness is mindfulness. The main cause of happiness is mindfulness and the outcomes of mindfulness. Mindfulness is the primary meditation practice that we do, present time, non-judgmental, kind awareness. Kindness is a key ingredient to happiness. You can't be unkind and resistant and resentful and be very happy. So developing kindness in our lives and a kind relationship to the present time experience, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Kindness is non, you know, kindness or mindfulness leads to non-attachment. Can't be very happy if we're clinging. Letting go causes happiness. Allows us to experience more and more contentment and ease and well-being and all of that. Maybe what's on the continuum. I'm kind of freestyling, but when I think of happiness, it is a continuum from joy, like intense joy is over here. And like, you know, really, really enjoyable, blissful, ecstatic, you know, if you like that shit, happiness, the intense kinds of happiness. And then I think maybe there's unhappiness over here, and then there's levels of contentment, levels of satisfaction that are all on this continuum of I'm happy when I'm at ease, I'm happy when I'm content with what is, when I'm accepting. I'm happy sometimes even when there's unpleasantness, but I'm not taking it personal. I'm meeting it with compassion. Compassion, pain met with compassion, you could say, oh yeah, I'm uncomfortable, but I'm quite happy. It's okay to be uncomfortable. I learned how to do that. I'm having uncomfortable emotions or uncomfortable sensations or uncomfortable repetitive thought patterns. But because mindfulness changes our relationship to the mind and the body and pleasure and pain, mindfulness creates the conditions to be happy. Without mindfulness, we tend to be in a habitual, reactive relationship to pleasure and pain. Without mindfulness, we tend to be self-centered creatures, to take everything personal, to believe our thoughts, to believe our views and our opinions and our self-centered fears. With mindfulness, we start to have a little bit of distance and a little bit of like, oh, my mind's quite afraid, but that's okay. That's not who I know, that I'm not my mind. I can be happy in the midst of anxiousness or in the midst of sadness or grief, sorrow, knowing that those are natural emotions that come through this human process that we call me. Mindfulness, deeply practiced, leads to the end of unhappiness. because of the compassion that it develops for pain, and because of the non-clinging, the non-attachment that mindfulness leads to for pleasure. Because probably the general sense of unawakened people is that I'm happy when life is pleasant. Pleasure makes me happy. I like stuff. I like things. I like things that smell good, taste good, look good, feel good. Pleasure as the source of, well, what an unreliable source of happiness. Because mindfulness wakes us up pretty early on to impermanence. And so if we're hanging our hat, taking pleasure as the source of happiness, even though we know it never lasts, so then happiness never lasts. And this is where the Buddha came along and said, how about a source of happiness that's not just pleasure-based? And even in meditation, it's one of the reasons why, I think it's one of the reasons why the Buddha rejected concentration-based bliss meditations. Or like, you know, those, you could go places where they like teach you how to hyperventilate and get super high. And they call it meditation, or they'll tell you to lay down and they'll ring a bunch of bells and get you a bunch, you know, the sound bath, and it'll get you super high and it's very pleasant. But it's not sustainable. It's not reliable. You can't walk around with a, you know, mobile sound bath in your life. You can't walk around hyperventilating all of the time, breathing through your nose and out through your mouth and count to seven, like, not reliable. The reliable refuge of mindfulness is because we can do it all of the time. It takes no bells. It takes no special breathing pattern. It just takes present time, kind awareness. That helps us see more and more clearly. So mindfulness, I believe, is the cause of happiness. And it's not the kind of pleasure, but the wisdom. Wisdom leads to a sense of happiness in our lives. One of the heart practices of the Buddha is appreciative joy, where he says, you know, not only can we learn to, through mindfulness and non-attachment and compassion, to be happy in ourselves and to enjoy pleasure with non-attached appreciation and to meet pain with non-identified compassion, non-aversion. He says also there's this opportunity, and it's empathy. You know, when you think about empathy, often we think about empathy as caring about someone else's pain and sort of compassion and empathy being connected of like, well, you're grieving and I care about you, or you're hurting and I care about you and I empathize with your pain. But the Buddha threw this curveball. He said, also remember to empathize with other people's happiness. Don't settle for just your happiness, but every time someone else around you or that you know of or is happy, you have the opportunity to kind of get a hit of it, to empathize with it, to feel it with them, to celebrate, to congratulate, to experience what was called appreciative joy. We're so self-centered in our conditioning that we often think about me and my happiness and my stuff and my money and my relationships. And there's a movement from self-centeredness that happens in meditation and in to altruism, to service and compassion for each other, but also to appreciation for each other, gratitude, and this empathy that connects not just with people's pain, that connects with people's happiness. One of the ways that the Buddha taught this, he says, you know, mindfulness led to freedom from suffering, freedom from self-centeredness, freedom from aversion to pain, freedom from attachment to pleasure. And when there was no more clinging and aversion and self-centeredness, what remained was loving kindness for all living beings. What remained was compassion for all living beings. What remained was a sense of appreciative joy for all of the beauty and joy and happiness in the world, both for the suffering and for the joy of existence. I am definitely guilty as a person and a teacher of focusing much more on the suffering, focusing much more on, and as the Buddha did, he started with, let's look at the suffering. Because when we're in suffering, we can't see the joy. We don't experience it. Suffering blocks it. It buries it. It suppresses it. So we need to address the suffering to get around to learning to empathize and appreciate and be a truly happy person in this world that will include pain, that will include difficulties, that will include stress and balancing checkbooks and doing paperwork and all of that stuff, but with a sense of wisdom, a sense of non-attachment, a sense of appreciative joy for each other. One of the reasons I wanted to throw that in there is because I thought that for the meditation, it's fun. I don't do this in class that often, more on retreat. Sometimes I do it. We'll do this appreciation meditation, and at a point in the meditation, I'll ask you to voice things that make you happy, things that you appreciate, things that you enjoy, things that, you know, kind of spark happiness in your heart and mind. And as a setup for that, I will say, I know sometimes we get real spiritual around here and we're like, well, it can't be. I know material things aren't the source of happiness, so I better not say that. But the truth is, I like stuff, but I'm not allowed to admit it. And we're trying to practice non-attachment, so I don't want to say, well, I'm fucking really attached to tacos. There's a list in the Buddha's teachings, and this is not an exhaustive list, but it's an interesting one, where he says there's four types of happiness that we experience. And he said the first type is sense pleasures. Even though attachment to sense pleasures causes us so much suffering, craving for sense pleasures, attachment, addiction causes us so much suffering. The truth is, when something smells good, tastes good, feels good, pleasant emotions, pleasant music, pleasant, you know, smells and tastes, really is a sense, you know, it's like that temporarily makes me happy. Dennis was joking with me during the small group, and he said, well, what about your lowriders? Your lowrider make you happy? And I said, yeah, but it's a very low form of happiness. Very low. Very dad joke. I feel like, because the second one on that list is material things, sense of happiness. He said, you know, sense pleasures and material things. You get a low sense, a kind of base sense of happiness from stuff. It doesn't really work. I'm always saying and preaching and believing and trying to practice in my own life that the stuff never is going to actually lead to any kind of long-term happiness. But it's fun when you're on the motorcycle or in the lowrider or get the new shoes or whatever material thing that you like. You get that new sweatshirt you needed. So you have 37 black sweatshirts. So there is a sense of, you know, so in the meditation, when I'm asking you to say things, it's okay to say sense pleasure-based and material-based things. Don't be so spiritual that you're like, only the Dharma is my only source of happiness. Just grateful for my meditation cushion. That's it, nothing else. I mean, the meditation cushion is also important, and the Dharma is so important. But let's not be fake about the truth of the pleasure and, you know, relative levels of happiness that we get from sense pleasures and things. The other two levels of happiness are the happiness of debtlessness and the happiness of blamelessness, and considered much higher. You know, to live a life of integrity, of blamelessness, of blameless in the eyes of the wise, living a life where you don't need to make amends to anybody because you're not intentionally causing harm to anybody. You're not being, you're living by the precepts, you know, blameless because you're not killing and lying and stealing and cheating, living a life of integrity, of non-harming out of our intentions. And debtlessness is financial. You never had that, you ever pay off your debts? Actually feels great. Most people, most Americans, like, no, mortgages and credit cards and student loans. And but if you ever get to that place where you're like, I don't owe anybody anything, it feels really good. When you kind of like, I paid off the mortgage, I paid off the car loan, I paid off the student loans. So part of it is financial, but I think it's also emotional debt. when you owe amends, when you've caused harm and you haven't made amends for it. Or when somebody's been very kind to you and you haven't sufficiently expressed gratitude. So really, you know, there's like a debt of gratitude, there's a debt of amends. Debtlessness is like a clean slate. Like, I've said everything that I need to say. I've expressed it. They know. And even if people have died and we didn't get to tell them, that we've done that in our heart. We've forgiven. We've asked for forgiveness. We've expressed appreciation. We've asked for forgiveness, all of that. Debtlessness, blamelessness, material things, sense pleasures. Not an exhaustive list. There's probably more. And we'll explore that together. But first, let's meditate. So find a way to sit that's upright, that's relaxed. Sit a way that makes you feel happy. The Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh used to suggest meditate with a half smile on your face. Put your body in the posture of, you know, like, because when you're happy, you smile. And you don't have to totally fake it, but rather than be having that sort of dour meditation, I'm fucking meditating so hard, just try to, like, you know, relax a little bit and maybe a little half smile if it's not too cheesy. Begin with mindfulness, with feeling the sensations of the body. And as you feel your body sitting here, breathing, also reflect on everything that you appreciate about your body, all of the things about having a body and whatever level of health it is that you're happy about. This body that's been carrying us around, allowing us to walk and talk and think and feel. Even if your body's not so healthy right now, maybe there was a time where you got to do more activities and be in the ocean in this body and hiking and whatever kind of activities you've enjoyed about being able to do with this body. Feeling it, mindfulness, and appreciating it, even if it's aging or injured or sick. And now that you probably already have been in the small groups and during my opening talk, just reflecting, let your mind think about all of the things that make you happy, that create the conditions for happiness, the meditation practice that helps alleviate the unhappiness, the friends, the wise friendships, communication, connection. The teachings, finding a philosophy that makes sense, that's practical, that's applicable, that works. So happy to have found the Dharma. Reflecting on your experiences of love and the happiness of love, family, friends, partners, this human ability to connect with our hearts, to feel passion, to feel connection. to give and to receive love. Reflect on all the sense pleasures that you enjoy, your favorite foods. Your favorite music. Your favorite activities. Gratitude as part of happiness. Thankfulness, appreciation. Appreciating all of the forms of pleasure and happiness that you experience. Perhaps even bringing some appreciation to some of the difficulties that have been useful. Coming into recovery for so many of us, such a painful process of ending addiction. Thinking of the material things. Your favorite things. When you think about your clothes, when you think about your furniture, your home, your automobiles. Bicycles, skateboards, skis, snowboards. Your bitchin' jet ski from the '80s. Think about the music. Think about the work that you've done so far in healing and recovering and awakening. The meditative wisdom that you've been developing, the amends that you've made, the appreciation, gratitude that you've expressed. The level of debtlessness that you've been able to experience so far. Think of the blamelessness, the times where you're honest, you're in integrity, you show up and do the hard thing, tell the truth. All of those times when you catch yourself before you react. And choose to respond with kindness. These are the sources of happiness in our lives. Each time we let go of something we've been clinging to, each time we meet something unpleasant with friendliness, with mercy and compassion. and extending this to each other, not just our own happiness, but the people that you talk to in the small groups, people gathered here to meditate, to discuss the Dharma. Extending this wish to them, may you be happy, may your happiness continue, may it increase. Just as I wish to be happy in my life, I also wish this for you, and may I learn to enjoy your happiness. This empathy, this appreciative joy, which is the opposite of envy and jealousy. The other side of celebrating and appreciating and congratulating each other. Send it to everyone gathered here. There's about 60, 70 people meditating together right now, both in person and online. Each one of these people with their own forms of happiness that you can appreciate. May your happiness continue and increase. And before we do the interactive part, just reflect for a moment that there are 70 people appreciating you right now. Breathe that into your heart. 70 people meditating, including you, in their appreciation, wishing for your happiness. As we continue to appreciate each other and wish for each other's happiness, this is the interactive part where you can begin to say out loud things that bring you happiness. And at home, you can unmute, say something, and then mute yourself again, and we'll just go for it.
The immensity of nature.
My house.
The ocean.
Taj. Yeah.
Being creative.
Surfing.
Meditating.
Cold water. Traveling.
Cuddling.
My cats.
Warm water.
And Jang.
Non-attachment.
Punk rock.
Plants.
Yarn.
Matcha latte.
Records.
Doing my art.
Bands. Donuts.
Helping others.
Action.
Right.
Amazing.
Cats.
Creativity.
Yeah.
Books.
The food selections at Air One.
Smiling dogs.
Biking.
Making love.
Laughing babies. Tacos.
Aisha.
Frisbee golf. nap.
Loving relationships.
The food I eat.
Doberman puppies.
My son.
B-52s.
Minor threat.
Learning new things.
Beautiful
class.
Babies.
Minimal videos.
My parents and my sisters and my nephews.
Sunsets.
Sunrises.
My cat bathing.
A renewed friendship.
Thai food. Getting tumbled by a powerful wave and breakfast burritos, losing myself in the company of the
people. Ozzy's pizza.
Finding things.
Continuing to reflect, continuing to extend your empathy to each other, extending this appreciative joy, empathetic appreciation towards the happiness that exists in our lives, outward in widening circles to include your friends and family that aren't with us right now, parents and children, people that we work with, people in our communities, people in our neighborhoods, outward in all directions. This planet of billions of humans experiencing billions of happiness at times. Beyond the human realm to the animals, all sentient beings, with gratitude, with appreciation, with a sense of cherishing. And the loving kindness teaching, the Buddha said, cherishing all living beings. Opening our heart, our mind to each other, to this planet, with compassion for the confusion, suffering, and ignorance that exists, and appreciation for all of the joy, happiness, beauty that also exists. So this focus on the practices, the tools, the perspectives that bring personal happiness into our lives, but also this opening of getting out of the self-centered, what makes me happy, and learning to appreciate what makes other people happy. And there is something, I don't know what it is in our wiring that creates jealousy. When other people are happy and you are successful and you kind of, instead of feeling happy for them, you feel threatened by other people's happiness. Seems like it's a universal human trait. Some part of our instinctual drives is jealousy and envy. It's sort of on every list of why life is difficult for people. And in order to get free from that, this intentional focus on appreciating and celebrating, empathizing, and to really start thinking about empathy beyond compassion, beyond just I care about your pain, and to actually practice I care about your happiness. I enjoy your happiness. I take pleasure in your happiness. It's almost like I get a hit from it. Is the way that I sense this teaching, that the Buddha said, when I was free from self-centeredness, I just was able to enjoy everybody else's happiness too, which coexists with compassion. And usually we're talking about caring about the suffering because it's so blatant. And the happiness maybe isn't always so blatant, so obvious. We have a negativity bias that's built into us. We see what's wrong rather than what's right. So much of what is cause of happiness, I think, is trying to be positive and optimistic and focusing on what's not wrong. And it's part of what we learn in mindfulness. You can shift your awareness around And the awareness wants to go to what's unpleasant, but you can actually direct your attention, your awareness, to what is pleasant. You don't have to always obey that negativity bias, that focus on what's wrong in my life or what's wrong in the world. And we can just shift it and be like, well, yes, we don't want to ignore it. You don't want to take this to the extreme where you become an idiot. a denial, delusion, idiot, and think like, oh, everything's beautiful, isn't it? There's lots of suffering, and compassion is most of our conversation. So necessary to not be in denial of the suffering. But since we are focusing on that primarily, let's not forget to focus on the happiness, the joy, what is right, what is beautiful, what is pleasant, what is sources of happiness in our lives. Connected, I feel like connected with this, and maybe it's, I'm not sure if it's something that we can, I think it's something that we can learn, but I also think that it's a natural sort of organic process of developing more wisdom, but not always, is a sense of humor, a sense of joy, a sense of laughter, a sense of playfulness. I'm aware of, there was one Zen meditation teacher who realized, you know, there's something about practicing Buddhism that can be so serious, and especially those fucking Zennies where they're like, you gotta sit upright and you gotta have the perfect posture and you gotta bow correctly. And, you know, some forms of Buddhism can be so serious. And he realized this is a joyless fucking crowd, the teacher. And so he sent all of his Zen students to clown school. And I thought that was fucking brilliant. Like, yes, learn how to have posture, learn how to have the form, but also have a clown nose, have a fucking, you know, one of those squeaky horns, and, you know, lighten up a little bit about your life and your spirituality so that you actually have an integrated sense of happiness and not just a stern meditation practice. When I was in Buddhist teacher training 20-something years ago, my teacher asked me, is there anything missing from Buddhism? And so I ask you that for, many of you have heard me talk about this, but it's like, you're gonna be a Dharma teacher. Is Buddhism perfect? Is there anything that's important to you that's missing from Buddhism? It's an interesting question, right? I mean, a lot of you maybe aren't, you're still sort of deciding whether Buddhism's for you or not. and maybe have multiple paths, and, you know, this is just one of the perspectives that you enjoy. But, you know, this question was, okay, you're going to dedicate your life to practicing and teaching, and is it a perfect path? Is there anything missing? And there was two things that came up for me back then. And one was humor. There's nowhere that I can tell explicitly in the way that Buddhism is recorded where a sense of humor is encouraged. It's, you know, some of the scholars that I've talked to, Buddhist scholars, they'll be like, well, if you read these stories, you know, like when the Buddha talks about blind people touching an elephant, he's making a joke. I'm like, but it's not funny. Do you know that story? He's like, you know, we're so self-centered in our perspective. He's like, you know, like if we were all had our eyes closed or we're blind and we were touching an elephant and I was touching the tail, and I'd be like, well, an elephant's like this. It's long and then it has this fuzzy thing at the end and somebody else is touching the spout. And they're like, no, an elephant is like this, because we're only seeing our part of the elephant that we're touching, our perspective. And we're so attached to our perspective. And so some scholar was like, well, that's the Buddha being funny. I'm like, I don't get it. I like the analogy of touching, of self-centeredness, but it's just not a fart joke. And I don't think the Buddha told any fart jokes. And I think fart jokes are hilarious, personally. Or whatever kind of humor that you have, playfulness, is part of expressing happiness, experiencing happiness, laughter, humor, playfulness. One of the issues when we get serious about integrity and right speech and honesty, and it can be tempting and common to be like, well, I don't want to be sarcastic because that's not really honesty, but sarcasm can be really funny if it's used appropriately, or to make puns, or to make fun of each other. I know for me, I've got a somewhat brash sense of humor where I love to tease and sort of, you know, when there's that kind of relationship, like just say the most awful things to my friends. And it's fucking hilarious. And they say the most awful things to me and it's hilarious, but it's within a sense of humor because it's that agreed upon. But technically, from somebody from the outside would be like, "Not that's not spiritual. That's not right speech. That's not." Keeping a sense of humor, lightness, I think really helps in having a sense of happiness in our lives. And that is also part of the not self, the non-identification of not being so identified with the personality as who we are, and not so defended of our, you know, it's okay for me to tease you, but don't tease me. It's okay for me to joke with you, but don't joke with me. Kind of self-centeredness. And as that self-centeredness hopefully starts to alleviate, there's an ease with playfulness, an ease with humor. I say not always because you, maybe some of you are this person, or some of you know this person that laughs a lot, but it's always sort of a defensive laugh. It's not really, they're not really having fun, but they're always sort of laughing to mask something, laughing kind of inappropriately in a situation where actually it calls for compassion, and they're laughing instead of feeling the pain and using that sort of masking laugh. So some people with really a tendency to have a lot of humor don't have a lot of compassion, don't have a lot of ability to be with the difficult stuff. They're always making a joke about everything all the time. And middle path of Buddhism, both. Learn to be with the pain, but also learn to be playful. Learn to have compassion. Mindfulness, as I began tonight, is the key. Present time awareness teaches us about impermanence. Impermanence teaches us the necessity of non-attachment. Impermanence also teaches us that this self-centered I, me, mine that the mind creates is not a reliable identity. Our minds aren't that trustworthy. And the more we learn that, the more general sense of happiness we have in our lives, even when life will be difficult. It doesn't make life easy. Just giving us a more ability to be at ease with life, whatever's happening. So these are some of my thoughts about happiness and humor and how mindfulness and Buddhism and appreciation are all part of the package. And just really wanted to do a deep encouragement for everybody to look at this in our lives and see how we can decrease the unhappiness and increase the happiness. And it really is what the Buddha's encouragement is. And it's one way to look at the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And I think that's about all I have to say about it tonight. So open to questions, comments, clarifications, anything, please.
One of the things you mentioned was the things that are missing from Buddhism. And something that I've been thinking about recently is, and I'd love your opinion on or just thoughts on, is I feel like the world is changing really quickly right now because of AI and social media, but I think predominantly a lot about AI. I feel like Buddhism is really good at helping you navigate being in the moment and maybe not being affected by some of those, but I feel as if it hasn't, I haven't really seen a lot of future guidance on like how to navigate things that are just moving faster and faster and faster and faster, especially because like these machines in some ways are not, they're intelligent, but they're not human intelligence, but they're becoming more part of our lives. So what are your thoughts from like a Buddhist perspective on how to navigate change that is happening at an ever increasing rate?
Could you hear most of that at home, or do I need to try to
nope.
paraphrase it?
No,
so
thanks.
The question was about that topic, that thing that I had said about what's missing from Buddhism, and about the kind of technology in particularly or in specific AI, and just the how does the Dharma, how does Buddhism help us navigate technology and advances in I don't know, I guess, you know, particularly artificial intelligence stuff. I don't feel like I have a clear answer, but I feel like mostly what I want to say is, and you know, this is kind of the answer to most things, is that mindfulness, present time awareness, that leads to wisdom and a wise relationship to our own mind and our own body and how we communicate and how we relate to things. The more we bring that present time wisdom to technology, whether it's, you know, the technology of vehicles or of computers or smartphones or it now, you know, the kind of AI stuff, non-attachment, compassion, and non-identification are always going to be the solution from a Buddhist perspective. Not being too identified with the mind as who we are. Not being too attached to things being the way we want them to be or that they used to be. And, you know, every generation goes through some form of struggle with the new technology, you know, whether it was like the radio or the automobile or the television or the beepers and cell phones, and you know, now it's computers, and you know, AI is the new kind of like, fuck, how are we gonna, you know, it used to be televisions are gonna destroy the youth, and now it's AI. And you know, you probably know a lot more about it than I do, and but I do feel like the core is going to come back to wisdom is going to help us navigate whatever it is. And the more we develop wisdom, wisdom of impermanence, wisdom of non-attachment, wisdom of compassion, the more we're going to be able to be like, this is a tool. This computer is a tool that allows us to talk across the whatever. Now there's this, you know, brain in it where it can actually help me with my homework. or my work or my whatever it is, editing, what, you know, like I'm not actually using AI yet, so I don't really know, but my kids are, they know all about it. And I feel like it's more and more often, you know, we used to have Siri, and I guess Siri is a form of AI, right? Or Siri was just like a web search thing, or like it, but now it's like an actual AI, and it'll like tell you more than just what websites you can look at for the information. It filters it for you or something. I don't utilize it much, so I'm not that familiar. But I would hope that wisdom will help us relate to it with less fear. You know, I know there's a lot of fear in our refuge recovery. There was, when we have a lot of online meetings, and there was a lot of fear about like, hey, there's these AI bots trying to come into the meeting and transcribe things, and you know, and there's a lot of fear about it. And maybe some of it is justified for, you know, but my sense is like, well, let's see. You know, the fact that now people can come to this, like somebody that was hearing impaired and, you know, can do it. And then there's an AI that can make the closed captions for them. And actually they could attend this, even though they weren't able to before because they couldn't hear me. And now they can, and they're using AI to, you know, attend these kind of things. And what a great use of that tool to be more inclusive, to, you know, not have a barrier for people that had a barrier before. Like everything, like the computers, right? Really good uses of them. And then, you know, mostly people just are looking at porn instead of all of the great uses of them, right? But both and is how are we using the tool? Please, Eric.
I feel a sense of, like, when you were talking about how there's no humor in Buddhism, right? And but then you also mentioned that you know, through mindfulness, you get to a point, you know, in non-attachment, that you'll get to a point where you're also celebrating people. You know, you're celebrating their wins and their victories and stuff like that. So my sense is that becoming a more humorous person is almost built into the practice, because after you release and let go, you know what I'm saying, and you're celebrating other people's wins, it can't help but to bring joy to you. Because I know all the teachers that have been practicing a long time, they're hilarious, man. You know what I mean? Like, even when we were in Thailand and stuff on retreat, and then even in India, like, these, they're just funny, just the way they carry themselves.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like they have so much peace within, you know what I'm saying? And that they're not even trying to be that way.
Yeah.
It feels like it's just built into the system itself, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know, just a thought.
Yeah, no, I like that thought. And it depends on what Buddhist tradition, you know, like I use the example of the Zen master sending his students to clown school, because Zen can be very serious. There's in the Theravadan tradition that I'm more familiar with, there's, like, in Burma, there was a tradition of the meditation teachers, the monks, teaching from behind this big palm leaf. And they didn't want to bring their personality into it at all. And so there was no humor. And it was just, this is how to practice mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Be aware of your breath as it comes in. And they were really trying to remove any kind of personality and humor from it. And then there's the Ajahn Chah school that that we went and visited. And Ajahn Chah seemed to have a sense of humor, and his lineage has a sense of humor. And someone like the Dalai Lama in the Tibetan tradition, who's, like, always kind of giggling and happy and joyous, you know. So there's the happy Buddhists, and then there's the dour Buddhists. I'm fucking getting enlightened before you are. There's both and, yeah.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Are there a chance?
Go ahead.
Frank. Are there a chance that aren't, like, because the ones that I in India, or in Thailand, I mean, I have a bag of bones filled with pus. I mean, it was very monotone and not celebratory. Are there chants that are more, like, crazy and appreciative?
Could you hear that question? So at this, like, with there's a tradition in many Buddhist traditions of chanting the teachings. Because the teachings aren't very, it was just a way to memorize the teaching. So it's often done very monotone, just so that you can, you know, kind of get in the flow and memorize it. There are some, you ever look at any of the Thich Nhat Hanh? Thich Nhat Hanh was an interesting Vietnamese Zen teacher, and he had a tradition in his tradition. He passed a few years ago. His tradition is alive and well. And he was really into people writing songs. And so you get all these monks and nuns with guitars writing these really cheesy Dharma songs and singing their joy, their little joy out. And it's so cringy, but you're just like, okay, you know, like, they're really going for it. Like, they're really, you know, celebrating their little Buddhist strum along. So, you know, like, in that tradition, he was like, hey, let's bring some life to this. And let's, you know, there's even some Thich Nhat Hanh raps. Very cringy, but also, you know, just a good opportunity for you know, celebration of joy. And so some traditions have tried to get, you know, but the Thai tradition that we went to, they're, like, the most, even though there was huge, you know, some of the teachers, when you get them out of that, are very personable and funny. When they're in that traditional chanting thing, they're the most serious Buddhists that there are, even worse than the Zen guys. Oh yeah, I mean, they're like, this is the tradition, this is the right way to do it, we're doing it the right way, and they're very serious about it. No joking there. But then if you get them out of that part and into giving a Dharma talk, they'll tell you some funny stories, and some self-deprecating funny stories about being a monk. And yeah, so they're light, but not while they're doing the traditional chanting. Serious business. We were in my first time in Thailand, it's a little over 30 years ago, and we were in these monasteries, and I was with some friends, and we were chanting, and we didn't really know the words yet. And it's like Nam-myoho Renge, or Namo Tassa Bhagavato, and it was over and over. And then my friend started saying, "God damn, those noodles were yummy." didn't really know the words, and we had just had some noodles for lunch, and so he just turned the chant into, "God damn, those noodles were yummy." Because, you know, leave it to the American kids to fuck it up. Please.
Do you know what the depiction of the happy Buddha, which I think comes from a Chinese Buddhism, where he's like fat and like rub his belly for good luck? So I wanted to ask if you have more information about that. Is that like a commentary on sensual pleasure? Like...
I don't know. So I know that the name is Hote. You know, that often there's that sort of, the Buddha is fat, right? And has the little beggar's bowl and is smiling and is happy. And when you see those big bodied Buddhas, it's not Siddhartha Gautama. It's not that guy. It's a Chinese monk that was like the happy, the laughing Buddha, or the happy Buddha. I think he was also maybe a bit of a boozer, you know, kind of one of those kind of like, I'm a little bit loaded. I'm pretty happy. But I don't know the Hote mythology very much. And it probably was a monk at some point and was a famous monk or something, but I don't know so much. Jason, do you know anything about Hote?
Just like saint of, is like a, yeah, prosperity. That's why you drop like that kind of hat, bringing in like prosperity and joy. That's all there. It's considered a saint, like
yeah.
A monk. That a monk. Was famous, similar to the Zenza or something like that.
Yeah, in Japan. Well, and then, you know, the big body thing is interesting because as you, the Buddha, when on enlightenment, was emaciated. And so really, like, the statues probably should be of a skin and bone skeletal Buddha. Like, we made one t-shirt of the emaciated Buddha. And that's actually where the Buddha's physicality was at enlightenment. He'd been fasting for years and was, you know, like near death, he said, when he got enlightened, and he started eating and gained a little bit of the health back, but very, very skinny. But because skinny means poor, and, you know, in maybe everywhere, but particularly in Asian cultures, as they started to make the statues, they made them bigger and bigger and more, you know, have a bit of a belly and, you know, big cheeks. And this is, you know, healthy, sort of a Tibetan version, because, you know, this is our teacher that it has to be prosperous and, you know, and healthy and heavy, because if you're skinny, it's because you're not prosperous in that culture. There was a hand here. Yeah, let me get yours, please.
And like being just at peace and kind of in your inner world, I've come to just like equate it with being passive. And then that, I don't know, I feel weird being passive in life and in a lot of situations, and it makes me almost feel like I'm not engaging with life. And just there's a part of me that's like, well, there's so much chaos in the world. I think it's a good thing to be so calm and at peace and just to yourself. But then there's another part of me that's like, that I feel like I should have a little bit of like following your desires, because that's like joy and that's life. So I just don't know where's the balance with that.
It's a good question. I don't know that I have the total answer. If you couldn't hear it at home, the question was about, like, you know, as we this idea of wisdom being kind of passive and non-reactive, and maybe even in traditional way to talk about it sometimes is to become dispassionate as we become non-attached. And so the question that I sit with in that is like, where's the balance between dispassionate non-attachment and compassionate engagement, including some empathetic joy and humor and, you know, so not so dispassionate that you're like disengaged, but an engaged life that is non-attached, that is compassionate, and that is happy, that is an experience of joy. Now, here's the maybe the bad news for most of us, is that no matter how enlightened you get, your personality is not going to change that much. The Buddha even talked about this. He said, you know, you're at some point you're either born with or, you know, you develop a personality, and even fully awakened beings don't get rid of their personality. You still have a personality, and it's how you relate to the personality. And he classified, he made like a personality test and three types, personality types. He said there's greed personality types, and there's hatred personality types, and there's delusion personality types. And whichever one of those you are, you're just going to have to live with it. And it's how kind of your mind works and how your personality is going to be. And wisdom of how you relate to your personality changes your level of happiness around it, not taking it so don't take your personality so personal. It's an impersonal personality. It's not your fault. It's not who you really are, but you are stuck with it. It's a little bit like the body that we have. It's not who we are, but it is what we're walking around in this incarnation. And, you know, so.
It all sounds so negative.
So the flip side, if you want to be positive and happy about it, you could say the greed type is a confidence type and faith and confidence. And I want everything and I know I can get it. I'm greedy for enlightenment and I'm sure I will become an arahant enlightened being in this lifetime. Right. So there's confidence in it. The hatred is discernment, right? The kind of judging mind that can be seen as pessimistic, but is actually usually right. You know, it's that sort of like, fuck the world. And it's like, yeah, the world is pretty fucked. there's a lot to hate, actually. There's a lot to be aversive about, and there's some discernment about that. It doesn't work, you know, hatred doesn't work, but there's a lot of discernment. And the aversive personality type is quite equanimous, not the aversive, the delusional. So it's like you're delusional, but you're actually quite sort of spaced out and peaceful and happy. You're not as self-centered usually if you're delusional type. You're just also not all the way here. There was another hand somewhere back there, yeah.
Meditate.
Yeah.
Everything
that's blocking happiness, destroy that which is in the way of your freedom. And so the classic, it's the same thing as the personality types. It's the same thing. The way that the Buddha talked about enlightenment, it's the end of greed, the end of hatred, the end of delusion. And even the term nirvana is related to the term nirodha, and nirodha means the destruction of that. The end of, the destruction of. So meditation destroys, erodes that greed and hatred and delusion that causes unhappiness in our lives.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Do you distinguish between practicing Buddhism versus being a Buddhist? Like, we're here in the West, we didn't grow up. We're all like a hybridization of all these different things. So, I mean, I practice Buddhist principles to quell compulsion along with other things, and probably like a lot of people in this room.
Yeah. I don't make a distinction, really. I don't know if people could hear the question. The core of the question was, do I make a distinction between practicing Buddhism and being a Buddhist? I don't really make a distinction. If you're practicing Buddhism. I probably use the term Buddhist, but Buddhism is a practice. It's not a faith-based commitment to dogma. It's a practice. So if you're practicing Buddhism and applying those Buddhist principles, you can call yourself a Buddhist or don't call yourself a Buddhist. Probably better to not be too identified with the religious part of it, and just to be, I'm practicing mindfulness and kindness and compassion and forgiveness, and this is helping me create happiness in my life and alleviate unhappiness in my life. Practicing Buddhist principles is being a Buddhist, but we don't need that label. And some people, I know the Dalai Lama was asked this question a bunch of times, and I liked what he said. He said, don't be a Buddhist unless you can't help it. Unless there's something in you that is just so drawn. He said, practice the principles, practice these things. And if you, you know, if you're happy with being a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew or an atheist, whatever, you know, like if you're happy with that, but Buddhist practices will help you, use those, use the practices, and you don't have to become a Buddhist unless you can't help yourself. And I feel like that's some of my experience and many people's, where it's like, it's just the only thing that makes sense. And it's the only thing that I really, can relate to enough to be at all identified with when it comes to spiritual traditions. And so, for lack of a better word, I'm a Buddhist, even though I'm really just practicing these principles in my life. Unless you can't help it, I liked that. If you can't help it, okay, you can be a Buddhist. That's probably...
I just had one quick
question. Sure.
It was like, to your earlier point, it was like, what's wrong with Buddhism? To me, like, I don't think anything's wrong with it, but we can get trapped by our own framework. And so sometimes identifying too much of a label and trying to define what that label is, lots of different kinds of Buddhism, it's like, well, I feel like your own, like, what you bring is pretty unique in itself. Mm-hmm. And so my entry was the refuge. So that to me is a unique modality.
Yeah, somewhat, and pretty traditional, pretty like, you know, even though I bring my personality all over this shit, and I bring some of my own views and opinions, you know, but what I teach is pretty traditional Theravadan, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, early Buddhist teachings. You know, the other thing, the thing that I put in Refuge that doesn't really exist in Buddhism that I borrow from the 12 Steps is the direct amends. Making direct amends, asking for forgiveness when we've caused harm, rather than just, I have the karma of the harm I've caused. The importance of making direct amends, I put that into Buddhism, into Refuge. It's not really part of Buddhism, making direct amends. Have a sense of humor, make amends, be happy. we'll end with that for tonight. Thanks, everybody, for being here.
Thank you.
Great. What announcements do I have? We've got a day long in a couple months in August. We're going to do a day long. I'll talk more about that later. I don't have any more retreats coming up for Against the Stream this year. I do have some refuge recovery retreats. I have one on the East Coast in October. This weekend, I'm going to Cape Cod to do the Refuge Recovery Conference. If you or anybody you know is interested or part of Refuge and wants to come to the conference, it's this Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday in Cape Cod. That information's on the Refuge Recovery website. The next big Against the Stream event that I'm doing is in November, where I'm taking a group to Sri Lanka. You're all invited to come to Sri Lanka with us. A bunch of people here in the room, in the Sangha and online are coming with us on that trip. We're going to spend 2 weeks in Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka is the most ancient Buddhist culture, continuous Buddhist culture. Buddhism went to Sri Lanka very early, around the Buddha's lifetime, just after, and has continued in a way where in India, where Buddhism was from, Buddhism basically died in India. And there's still some pilgrimage spots, but it's not really practiced by the people. Like less than 1% of Indians practice Buddhism. But Sri Lanka, just about everybody is practicing Theravada and Buddhist culturally. And in the tradition. So it's a very interesting country to be in. And it's a beautiful island with great beaches. And we were talking earlier about when we're going to go scuba diving when we're there. And so it's not just a retreat. It's a Buddhist adventure with the community. And we're going to have some silent retreat time. And we're going to have some beach time. We're going to have some elephant sanctuary time and some time to go shopping and, you know, do the kind of tourist thing and see a bunch of cool temples. There's a temple in Sri Lanka where they claim to have one of the Buddha's teeth. It's called the Temple of the Tooth. And they're like, you see that? That was the Buddha's tooth. I'm not sure if it's true, but that's what they believe, and they worship this relic of the Buddha. One of the Buddha's tooth. I don't know. We'd have to ask. We'd have to ask if, you know, 2,600 years later, is that possible? Do teeth last for 2,600 years?
It's a bone.
It's a bone, yeah, I guess. So, well, so in Buddhism, you burn bodies. But then after you finish burning the bodies, there's little pieces left. And they're like, well, there was a tooth and there was a collarbone and there was a fingernail. So let's worship those things, which is really fucking weird. Yeah. Okay, so George has an announcement. George has been doing, you know, co-facilitating off the cushion service stuff, and he's got an announcement.
Yesterday, we did our first food outreach program. We made 100 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and cookies, and we had some water, and we walked along the boardwalk, and we handed out 100 sandwiches in less than an hour. It was probably a lot of really hungry people, so that was really awesome thing. We were going to do a sock drive, so there's a box up here collecting new socks, unused, you know, clean socks, that once we get a good collection, we'll donate to one of the shelters or something. You know, Food Care is a really important piece of health and safety and, you know, just like the comfort I think that people are really lacking. So if you have if you're at CVS, buy a pair of socks for the 99-cent store or whatever the hell it is. And then bring them in, throw them in the box. Maybe by the end of the month, we'll see how many we have. And if anybody knows a place that could use them, let me know. Lastly, we're organizing a group to go to the No Kings Day protest, which is on June 14th. There's going to be a protest at Lincoln and Jefferson at 2 o'clock. They're all over the city. They're all over the country. There's over 1,000 protests planned for June 14th. And so if you want to participate with the group, come talk to me afterwards. We have a WhatsApp group. I'll add you to that. We were talking about meeting before, maybe making signs here or doing something like that, and then rolling down to the protest. So,
what time does that start?
2 o'clock.
Yeah. On the 14th. And we'll announce that. We'll have another couple of Mondays to announce that.
Nice. Yeah. So. Yeah. Any questions or ideas, suggestions, please come talk to me after. There's actually a few of us that are participating. Thank you, everybody, that's been helping. And it's fun, it feels good, and kind of make the world a little bit better. So thank you.
Thanks, George. For those of you at home that couldn't hear that, we're doing some service-based and political action-based stuff here in LA. And one of the things we're doing, let's see, is this sock donation drive thing. So if any of you at home want to mail some socks to Against the Stream, 2516 Lincoln, we can distribute those for, you know, here in the Venice to the unhoused community who have dirty socks We can give them some clean socks. But also, you can just do it in your own neighborhood. You can just go out and give things to people and be of service in that way, if you feel moved to do that. But if you want us to do it, we're happy to help you distribute that stuff. Lastly, class is done by donation. Please be generous. We need the support in order to continue to operate as a donation-based meditation center. So give what you can, whatever feels appropriate. May any goodness that comes from our practice and discussion of happiness and the path to happiness, may we share this outward in all directions with all living beings. May each one of us get as free as possible. And together, may we create a positive change on this planet.
Thanks, Noah.
Welcome. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.